Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Well, welcome to another live show. Well, I'm glad to say we've got a special guest on tonight because I'm joined by Steve Jones to talk about permaculture and housing cooperatives and living together. I am having a bit of a problem with my Skype, so we might have to play another tune and set it right, but can you hear me, Steve?
Good evening, Dr. Rock. It's lovely to be here. I hope you can hear me loud and clear.
Yeah, I'm actually hearing you a lot clearer than I'm hearing myself at the moment, but hopefully we'll be able to muddle through. Thanks a lot for joining us on People's Internet Radio. It's a pleasure to have you here, sir.
It's great to be here, thanks. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, and you. It's I think it's an apposite time to be talking about permaculture as well, because in the way of things, you get to see occasionally sort of articles written about it that don't seem fully to understand what's going on. I've read ones particularly by a guy called Peter Harper recently from CAT. So it'd be really, yeah, quite. He seemed to me to be having a bit of a gentle go at it. You entitled the talk that you did at the Conscious Tribal Gathering earlier this year, Permaculture, Design and Transition, Facing the Challenge of Our Times. I guess you had good reasons for coming up with that title.
Well, yes, it is, you know, and I've struggled for a long time, you know, as well. I'm someone who's very tuned into the ecology, biology, I don't know, side of things. I pay attention to a lot of things. I'm actually very interested in economics and economic system as well. But someone who grew up on a farm and grew up in the countryside, you know, kind of has an empathy for how nature and ecology, environment work. It's hard not to be really, really concerned about the whole climate change thing, you know. And what I like to say to people is, look, climate change isn't the problem. Climate change is a symptom of a problem, a much bigger problem. And that is, you know, we're killing the ecology of our planet. We are eroding into it at quite a certain rate. And really understanding that on a deep level isn't a comfortable, easy thing to live with, to be honest. It's because you're constantly thinking about it, aware of changes, responses, you know, things that need to happen in the light of that fact. So, my whole permaculture journey is coming to terms with that and trying to find responses, you know, in this kind of slightly crazy time.
Yes, yeah, I quite see where you're coming from there. I'm just having a bit of a wrestle with the levels here. Let's just have a quick chat. Actually, I think, Steve, I'm going to put a tune on and I'm going to give you a ring back on your Stevie Ray Vaughan there and the Rude Mood whilst we sorted out a few technical difficulties. I think everything should be a lot clearer now. Thanks again, Steve. You still there, sir?
I am indeed, yeah. Great to be back. Great to hear about Stevie Ray Vaughan, actually. I enjoyed that.
He's a bit good, isn't he? He plays like a man with 10 fingers, I always think.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, the basic fact of all of this is really, isn't it, is that whether we hold with the theories of climate change or whatever the causes are, our environment is radically changing, and as much as anything, it's changing because of the things we're doing, isn't it?
I think there's an unequivocal case to argue into that. Yeah, absolutely. It's not just dumping all that CO2 into the atmosphere. We've raised it up to 400 parts per million. It was 275. We've also, you know, removed the whole of the tropical forest belts with eroding heavily into soils. We're interrupting the hydrological cycle. We're removing whole species and eroding into whole ecosystems. Yeah, we're having a really, really big impact. But, you know, 50% of the surface of the Earth is still wild. It is still as it was.
Yes, quite a lot of it's actually unexplored except from the air, isn't it? I was surprised to find.
It's also very true. And nature has an incredible dynamic built within it. It can heal itself and rebuild. And permaculture, well, certainly about permaculture right from the outset was, hey, it's a relatively simple set of techniques which you can use to restore and rebuild whole ecosystems. So we can put it all back. And we're probably going to have to do that if we're going to sort out this climate issue.
Yeah, because we are enabling soil to be stripped from the land at an incredible rate, and that's a lesson that we should have learnt a long, long time ago. I guess it's just profit that's driving people to continue doing it, but we can easily work in the other direction, can't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, under natural circumstances, it takes 1,000 years to form an inch of topsoil. 1,000 years, 1 inch, and yet we can lose, you know, we lose vast amounts of topsoil every single year. We can speed up those processes so we can rebuild soil faster by interacting with nature a bit more and, again, understanding those processes more. But that to itself, nature rebuilds itself, but really quite slowly.
Under some circumstances, it can work quite quickly. I know on one of the big gardens I looked after, it had a bit of what was the A470 on it when they rebuilt it and straightened it out. And kind of 10, 15 years later, you could barely see it. I was really overjoyed at how the trees had kind of come up, and you could just about make up where the curb would have been. But it's amazing how fast nature can work when it wants to.
Absolutely, as long as it hasn't been taken too far back, you know. And also, I mean, within permaculture, we're very much reminded that 99% of all life on this planet is microbial. So as long as the microbes are in place, they can again rebuild the biology from the bottom up. But once they're gone, it takes a long, long time to bring it back.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And I guess that, I mean, we're inevitable, where we are already in the midst of really, really serious and challenging changes, but they're clearly going to be a lot of stuff, as you said, to be experienced in our lifetime. And I guess the best thing we can do is help to shape that change, isn't it, by interacting with it.
It excites me. On quite a big fundamental level, that this is the time that we happen to be alive, where we can actually really get to make a difference. And it is, and we really can shape that. The decisions we make now make a very, very big impact, you know, as you multiply them going forward. I think it is. And as much as I engage with people and talk to people about these issues, is I always quickly try to steer it onto a really positive message. It's not about the gloom and doom of the damage we've done. It's about the possibilities that are to, you know, restore and regenerate, and the interesting times and, you know, satisfaction that we can have in the process of doing that.
Yes, because all change kind of creates opportunity, doesn't it? It's one of the basic principles of permaculture.
Absolutely, principle number 12. Yeah, you know, and it also really states that the only inevitability about life is change. It's constantly changing. It's never the same.
Which makes it a really great thing that it creates opportunity, doesn't it? Because it means opportunities are being created moment by moment, and they're unavoidable.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's just a matter of, yeah, if you like, harnessing that working in some kind of a harmony with that process. Because also the way that nature changes is sort of predictable. You know, tides go in and out, and sun goes up and down, and the seasons cycle around, and compost breaks down, water flows downhill, warm air rises. They're all kind of observable and understandable things that are quite consistent. So again, if you build systems around that conform to those patterns of changes that happen, you know, then everything has the opportunity to be much more productive with much fewer inputs.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we need to be thinking about right now.
And your experience of these sort of things started quite a long time ago, didn't it? Sort of 20, 30 years ago in another part of the world entirely. What first drew your attention to, well, how would you distinguish permaculture from the sort of standard approach, and how did you first encounter it?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a far-reaching question, but yeah.
That's great. I'll open another bottle.
The thing about permaculture that differentiates it for me and from, say, agroecology, or, you know, just talking about the farming, the nature side of it, is firstly is the people care side of it. Permaculture really recognizes that none of this stuff, none of the good green eco stuff happens without energizing the power of people, engaging with people, and meeting the needs of people. And So it's very human centric as well as being really concerned with nature and natural systems. So that's really appealing about it. And it's also a lot about personal choice as well. It's not actually dictating to anybody what to do, but it's inviting you to observe and to make decisions based on those observations. So it's very logically driven as well. But I think that, in essence, is what differentiates permaculture from just being about understanding natural systems, you know, or organic, integrated organic farming or something like that, because it's more than that. How did I get there? What drew me towards it? Again, sort of a long story, but is I've been interested in these things throughout my whole life. Again, you know, I kind of grew up on a farm and played in nature as a kid, and, you know, without questioning, you know, just enjoying, you know, just the way that you do as a child. And then slowly seeing farming change, you know, what used to be lots of different fields with different crops in them, and little woods and coppices and ponds and streams in between the fields and stuff. All of that got levelled off and drained and turned into one big field and reduced down and everything. So just even as a kid, I could go, well, what's going to happen to all those little things that live in the stream and the birds that eat them? And the, you know, you realise that all of that ecology is all interconnected. You can't just flatten it and there not be consequences. So started thinking about that maybe at quite a young age. And ended up at university, studied development and economics and ecology. So kind of two things that often kind of conflict with each other. But, you know, I started to think right from that age, really, that if you get the economics and ecology working together, then there's possibilities of doing things that make much more sense. I spent most of the 80s being feeling alienated and angry because of the whole sort of Thatcher thing, got very caught up in campaigning and placard waving and, you know, generally being pissed off. And then I reached the point where I thought, actually, that isn't where I want to be at. I don't want to be constantly angry or constantly annoyed by everything, you know. So it kind of drove me to start thinking about solutions rather than reacting to problems, actually trying to find positive responses. And that, through a long series of coincidences over the next few years, kind of led me to permaculture. And I met someone who explained it to me, and I thought, it was just like a light bulb going on inside my head.
What was that key point? What do you remember from that interchange?
Well, I think one thing was, it said, look, basically, we all depend on soil. So if you're interested in sustainability, it's either you're accumulating soil, and therefore you have the possibility to go on forever, or you're degrading soil, and therefore, whatever you do, you're kind of, you know, going to hit a wall. And I just suddenly realized that's on the bottom line. That's how simple it is to understand the nature of, you know, whether something is sustainable or not.
It's been my feeling since I started gardening some couple of decades or so ago, seriously, that what we're here for is to make soil, to actually facilitate a process which naturally occurs. I love making compost and soil, leaf mold and all of that. It's amazing. But even when you're doing that, actually, you're still only creating subsoil. We're only still only chasing the subsoil away a couple of milli. Yeah, you don't speed the process up that much.
No, you don't. So again, permaculture kind of teaches you, yeah, you can't really accelerate nature. You know, it has its own pace. There's only so many, you know, the cycle of the seasons and everything. It was the first thing that then started to feel like to join all these different thoughts together. Because I'd done a bit of teaching. I'd done a bit of garden building. I'd done a bit of campaigning. I'd done a bit of traveling. I'd done a bit of, you know, the whole way working for organizations. I'd done the whole campaign, you know, the whole spectrum of things that we end up doing in the West here. And it all felt unconnected and sort of not very relevant.
And you were perfectly placed as well to watch what was happening on the farms to have some idea of just exactly what it was you were trying to deal with, which must have been helpful.
Helpful to have a kind of, yeah, like a baseline to compare things to. Yeah, absolutely. Having seen, not to have a rosier view of how it was, because it weren't necessarily such productive farms and stuff, but it was teeming with nature, and it really isn't anymore. And that was what so shocked me. As a kid, I remember driving around in the, you know, family car, or whatever, and it being coated in insects, you know, in the summer. By the end of the evening, you have to stop almost to clear the window of lace wings and what have you. Does that happen anymore?
No, it's quite so, and it is a process, I think, that has continued. I mean, when I used to be in amongst the hedgerows, they used to be buzzing with insect life, and now they are more or less completely silent. I noticed you said you did development, economics, and ecology, and I can see how trying to tie the economics with the ecology would probably make it work better. How did you find the development part of your course?
Gosh, it was really interesting, but it took me quite a long time to fully and to understand really what it was about, because I didn't have enough reference points outside of academia to really understand it. But I went to North Africa and I went to India and started to kind of see the outside world a little bit. You start to realize, yeah, it's really interesting. But what ended up realizing was the thing that's whole, so I specialize in African development, which is why I ended up going and spending time there ultimately. But what became apparent was why all of the African development models fail is because the economic model is just stacked against them. It's just a completely unfair system. And it doesn't matter what development models people follow, they're going to fail when you've got military intervention and deposing, you know, all the stuff that we know goes on, all that skullduggery that goes on in the background, you know. You kind of realize that's not the thing that's holding them back. It's the wider political and economic framework that's holding back developing nations in a lot of ways.
And as you say, the economics fundamentally currently underpins everything and has been made to kind of underpin food growth to our cost. And it's basically one of unmitigated growth, isn't it?
Well, essentially, yes. And this is, again, the difference between our current sort of free market economic models and permaculture. Is permaculture has values embedded within it. It's had ethics embedded within it. And it's constantly trying to steer back to trying to be better for the environment, trying to be better for people, trying to constantly invest surpluses back into that. Whereas the current economic model is just about, is actually, it encourages you to externalize the cost of production, to avoid environmental tariffs, avoid unionized labor force, avoid, you know, try and find the cheapest way to produce, and to do it regardless of whether it makes the world a better place or not, but just doing it because it makes GDP growth happen.
And I guess
GDP growth was the end objective of the economy.
Yes, and the GDP is, of course, effectively the only thing they measure.
Yes, which tells you nothing. It tells you the throughput of resources at best. It doesn't give you any real indicators of whether is that a good thing or a bad thing. Did that make people's lives better or worse?
And we know quite a lot of it's being throughput to landfill and stuff when it could be being eaten on the way through.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah. So at the end of the day, I actually think we'll solve the environmental problem by reforming the economic models. And the thing that attracted me towards permaculture was it actually gave a language of words and concepts and ideas that enabled us to start to have proper grown-up conversations around sustainability and transition, rather than just waving your arms in the air and going, we're all doomed, or whatever it is that we're supposed to do.
And food is a great place to start, isn't it? Because there are open spaces where we can grow, and although there are skills involved, if we work together, we learn pretty quickly. And people enjoy it seems to me, when they get to have a go at it.
It's almost, yes, it works every time. I've done a lot of community gardening work and growing in public spaces, and I think that's a really, I think I talked about that at my talk a bit in the summer, but there's so much dead urban space, there's so much underused urban space, there's the road verges and the traffic circles and around the car parks and, you know, whatever, there's just acres and acres and acres of it, and the first opportunity is to reclaim that. Just start, it's ours, it's nobody's, it's everybody's, and start cultivating it. It's very easy to plant fruit trees and take 2 or 3 years before they start yielding, but then suddenly you start getting quite a lot of stuff, and these are things that harvesting and processing food and making jams and making wines and things are, you know, great activities to bring people together, build community.
Which is, I think, one of the most important aspects of the whole thing.
Yes.
Because
which again, which takes us back to the permaculture thing is look, oh, we want to be green, we all care about the earth. But actually, the most empowering thing, the first step is, you know, get to know your neighbours. Start to reclaim, start to garden, start to take responsibility for the space around you, where you live, you know. That's a good start, and that's empowering, and it makes you suddenly, you know, unexpected connections happen with other people who have similar attitudes. And,
once you start putting people together, I'm always amazed at what new things arise as people start talking to each other.
Yeah.
And gardening is a really useful and productive and politically neutral place to put people, but it's also that I think the best way to get to know people is by working with them.
Absolutely. It's the only way, yeah, it really is, because it's real then, because you're actually doing something. So I think that a lot about this, like community gardening, is by coming together to plant an orchard, start a raised bed or something, you've collectively created an asset that belongs to nobody, and that's the building block of community. It's a really powerful thing to do.
Very good point.
And stepping away from, this is mine, my garden, my fence, get off my land. It's the exact opposite, is creating things that we own collectively.
I often look at people's gardens and imagine how much bigger the whole lot would be if you didn't have fences in between them. They're a tremendous waste of space.
Well, absolutely. And everybody's replicating the same little thing. Like, okay, we don't like monoculture, we like polyculture. But every garden having their little strip of onions and their little strip of potatoes in their little veggie corner. I mean, it's kind of cool if you want to do your own thing, fine. But if you want to actually grow food, that's not the way to do it. You know, you should scale it up a little bit and develop a bit of, you know, get good at it. And you can have a lot more fun that way as well. You get a lot more incentive to do things if you really start getting good at it, and it starts to really feed you and produce a lot of food.
And again, one of the best ways of learning is to work with other people, I think. Because best practice comes out pretty quickly.
Very true. Very good point. And of course, to extend that point is the best learning environment for children is to play around adults who are interacting in those kind of ways.
I think the children particularly love it as well. I remember a local school here was given a greenhouse, and I went along to help set up a gardening club there, and they were unbelievably thrilled to be out there with hose pipes, and they were fascinated by the bugs and the soil, and it was really great, like seeing them come to life. And that's another thing about it, of course, is it works across the generations. There's things that little people can do, and there's things that the older people can do as well. And a lot of them are getting sidelined by our current setup.
As a kid, there weren't that many things that I felt comfortable doing with my parents, you know, that same awkward generation gap sort of thing. And actually gardening was one of those ones that always had that. You know, there's always something to do or to talk about or, yeah, work alongside each other. It's really, really important to have those things. And if they don't exist, then you literally don't get to know those people, you know.
Mm. So that's a really key point, isn't it? Because I think that in all of the discourse I've been reading about permaculture recently, that is not something I've seen emphasised, is the central position of people and community in it. And I think it's a very, very important point.
Yes. And it really begins even from a step before that, which is around the personal empowerment as well, is just inviting you to take more responsibility for yourself. And I think in this time now when, you know, okay, we've been talking about climate change, this is a global issue. This is something that's happening over a long period of time, over a very vast space that involves billions of people. So how the hell do we relate to that as individuals? And I think part of the reason why climate change hasn't connected with the populace in the way that it should do is because it's a big amorphous thing. It's very hard to personalize that, you know, and feel connected to that. Whereas permaculture starts from you and actually say, what do you want? What matters to you? What makes you feel good? What makes you feel energized? And, you know, maybe you should meet some of your own needs first. Make yourself a slightly more effective person. And then with that extra enablement that you have, you're better able to support the people around you.
And actually just the decision and the intent to interact can start changing the way things unfold for you, can't it?
Of course it does. Of course it does. If you go experience life as you're a victim of events that are beyond your control, then the idea there's nothing you can do to change it, is there? So you're just being blown about by the wind as far as you're concerned. But as soon as you realise, oh no, everything's connected to everything else, I'm part of it, therefore everything I do matters and changes the world in some small way, it's a much more interesting proposition to go through your day, isn't it?
It certainly is, and you start to get to make individual choices, even if it's only on a small scale, as opposed to being part of what is by and large a mechanised and form-ridden society.
But everything you do is a choice. So everything you do is a chance to vote for the world that you want in every interaction that you make. In the same way as in the garden, whether you pull a weed up or whether you, you know, leave it or whatever, these things have consequences. So we go through life constantly interacting with thousands of things every day in all sorts of little ways. But if we do that in a slightly more conscious way, working towards a collective, wider goal, you know, that makes a really big difference.
So would we think this is a key aspect of permaculture as well, the kind of conscious interaction with other people and the environment?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that sense of empowerment that comes with it, you know. Realizing that, you know, yeah, in every action that you're doing, you are in some way making a difference, and that difference will resonate out in different ways that, you know, cause consequences way over the horizon that you'll never know about. But
That's absolutely great. And again, it's a point we do try to make quite regularly on the show, that one, because I don't think it is necessarily recognized by everybody. If we do realize that every interaction we're having is making a difference, say for better or for worse, then the best thing we can do is treat the other people around us with a degree of respect to help them recognize that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we had a fantastic experience last year. There's a local charity here that works supporting farmers out in Uganda. We got to go out and visit some of their projects, and they took us up to Mount Elgon, where they're doing in the east, big mountainous region, and they grow coffee. But they're not just growing coffee. The place got horrendously deforested over the last decade. There's been a sort of turmoil in Uganda over the years, as probably you know. And slowly things are settling down, and they're starting to get things right there. But they really suffered from deforestation. And they put a project in place that re-establishes the long-term canopy of a tropical forest, but underplants it with, you know, bananas and cocoa and coffee and things that give more, you know, give economic yields, but also help them rebuild the forest ecology and put the, you know, repair the landscape.
And are they using the kind of 3D planting techniques that were brought forward by permaculture?
It's straight agroecology, what they're doing. It's straight out of the permaculture handbook. They're not calling it that, but because they haven't joined all the dots, but they're already doing it in that way.
So what are they doing?
They're creating a really high quality product from it as well. It's not just this double A grade coffee and, you know, equatorial grown high in the mountains. You can imagine it's something really special. And they can market that directly through networks to people who really care about that stuff. And it's only a kind of thing that makes a massive difference. And you can see it happening over this huge landscape. And that's just a decision about a cup of coffee. And you make that decision, tea, whatever, several times every day. So that's how empowered we are, we should feel. Just these little decisions that we make, if we can push that little bit of energy consistently in the right direction, then forests get planted. The really good stuff happens.
And a bit at a time is the way it does happen, isn't it? As we know from the man who planted trees.
Absolutely. Well, again, from looking at nature, you go, oh, nature, like, it's all slow and it's a bit random, but it's relentlessly moves in a defined direction, which is it constantly builds complexity and, you know, whatever, it does what it does, but it's relentless in that, and that's something we can observe and learn from and be inspired by. And, you know.
Was it a Ugandan project you were talking about at the gathering where people were given a mango tree?
That's right. And again, I thought that was lovely. And I don't know whether I told the story exactly correctly or not, but it doesn't really matter. But it's I love the idea of the linking actions together there. So rather than things being a single, like one off, oh, I've got a good idea, let's plant a tree and then forget about it, you know, is people were invited to plant a mango tree and they had to attend a day's training and a community building session. And they'll get to meet each other and do traditional dancing or whatever and eat pies or whatever, you know, and then they take a mango tree home at the end of the day. And if after, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months, whatever it is, the mango tree's still alive, they can come back to the centre and they can get a baby turkey. And they take the baby turkey back home and they fatten that off and it eats the, you know, rotten fruit from the mango tree and all the other sort of stuff. And then that can then be sold at market once it's mature, and that raises enough money for the components to build a solar panel. And the solar panel, they can charge up a phone and a light, which is the main limiting factor they have going forward, you know, because it's dark at 6 o'clock in the afternoon and kids can't do their homework and no one can afford, you know, they don't have electricity.
It's difficult to imagine that here, isn't it, that it gets quite suddenly light at 6 in the morning and then quite suddenly dark at 6 at night.
That's it. And if you've walked an hour and a half back from school or something, which is pretty normal there, then there's no chance of doing homework.
That's another interesting point, I think, is that the successful permacultural projects that I visited have actually tied several things together, like the growing of the mango tree and the turkey and the electricity. So it's kind of power and all useful stuff for the people that are benefiting from it as well.
There's a strategic approach, which is about addressing limiting factors. So it's like nature wants to be abundant. You know, people want to be successful. They want to generally, if things are, you know, with a fair wind, things usually work out all right. So why isn't it? What's the thing that's holding it back? Whatever situation it is you're analysing. And if you can identify the limiting factor, then you only have to treat that and then you'll move forward until you hit the next limiting factor. But if the limiting factor is the kids can't do their homework because it's dark at 6 p.m, then what they need is a light. They don't need more food or, you know, whatever it is. That's that little thing that makes a big difference.
And of course they get to charge their mobile phones, which are very popular, aren't they?
That is, again, is another story, and something which excited me as well was the realization. So, okay, in Uganda, across the board, they have a higher take-up usage rate of mobile phones than we do. They also have better coverage, better service coverage. And one of the main reasons for that being the case is that they've never had fixed lines. I mean, you know, they've only gone join the fixed copper cable landlines and you ever join the main city together. 75% of the population still live in essentially mud hut villages, you know, in rural areas. So the whole population has got online and on the phone and their first ever bank account all at the same time. And it's like this sort of idea of technological leapfrogging. They've gone straight past the sort of messy stage of having to have phone lines everywhere and gone straight to our second-hand throwaway Nokias from the last decade. They've all got those. Worked out a system of banking. They can send text credit to each other as a SMS message. And so you can, it's become a quasi form of money that doesn't go through the bank. It's really smart.
That's honestly one of my favourite stories of 2015, your moving credit around on the phones. Perhaps you'd like to just let people know how that works, because it's awesome, I think. We could learn something from this one, folks.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, you've got to think about a population of people that have never had bank accounts. And just how that might just facilitate really simple trade transactions. So if I travel to market and it takes me 2 or 3 days and I sell my goats and then I've got to travel back for 2 or 3 days, that money that I've just turned and got in cash is, you know, it's out of circulation. When now I can turn that money from selling my goats at market, for example, into phone credit. I can text that phone credit back to my village, to my wife or whatever, and she could pay the school fees with it. Or, you know, put some diesel in the tank of her truck with it or something like that. You can literally, the first time I ever got a really mobile form of money. And, I can just keep it on my phone and use it as phone credit. Or I can use it to pay for something else with another person out of my network. They've actually created a banking system that circumvents the bank.
As you say, they've done that because they didn't get used to having the banks in the first place, which
just out of necessity is the mother of invention, you know?
Yeah.
Just the sheer creativity is theirs, maybe. And there's little yellow booths everywhere. Every marketplace has got 3 or 4 of them. And you can go to the guy in the yellow booth and you can swipe the barcode on your SMS and it cancels the message and he gives you that money in cash. And there you have to pay a percentage, but otherwise the fees are very low. Even though it's much cheaper than the banking system.
That is just absolutely bloody great, that is.
And it's just energised their economy. So I just suddenly thought, you know, these guys, they might be living in mud huts and eating bananas. Actually, they're in the 21st century, kind of more than we are. Because we're still vested heavily in the 19th century. We're still trying to hold an infrastructure together that was built for coal and steam trains and stuff, you know, and heavy, yeah. You know, sort of the what we've inherited from the Victorian era.
Which itself.
Well, they haven't. I mean, they grow 90% of their own food organically, and 75% still live pretty much off grid, and, you know, get the right bit of alternative technology in there. I mean, suddenly you've got a really viable, low carbon standard of living, you know.
And feeding, giving themselves, you know, providing 90% of their own food and organically, that's pretty impressive as well.
I mean, they have got fantastic soils, really amazing soils, so, you know, it kind of helps. But yeah, basically, as a development template, it's not bad, you know. And I think going back to your question about development and stuff, I think I sort of have this vision for the future, and it's sort of 90% mud huts and, you know, whatever, ram, cob houses and thatch and whatever, localized and organic systems. Pretty much like what we've had for thousands of years. Really good gardening systems growing. You know, 2/3 of our food maybe in gardening systems locally and stuff like that. It takes 30 years to get there. But married with, high technology, with information technology. And, you know, we have to use a lot less energy, but the energy that we do use, we can use really smartly, and we can have, you know, an advanced capitalist economy, if you like, and, you know, but largely focused on 90% stuff is local.
I think the UN concluded recently, didn't it, that actually you get more food from these small organically managed farms than you would out of the monocultures.
Absolutely.
Which I was surprised to see them coming to that conclusion, but I wholly applaud it.
It's, you can't do the analysis and not draw that conclusion. So I guess I just finally dare to ask that question. The smaller the farm, the more productive it is per square meter, basically. And it's quite a simple formula.
Mm.
It's because you pay much more attention to detail. You don't create big monocultures, which are obviously very unnatural and take a lot of energy to maintain. And you have many more edges. Permaculture encourages you to observe edges. So where one thing comes up against another, one system comes up against another, you get a unique set of circumstances. So the more edges you create, the more kind of interestingness and variation you tend to get. So, I don't know, where the sea meets the shore, it's that intertidal bit, that's where all the birds hang out, that's where all the shellfish are, that's where all the interactions go on, in that edge bit. And you can, in small farms, those sort of complicated, interesting patterns get repeated many, many, many times over.
And the
big monoculture system.
Yeah, and the monocultures are awfully exposed to environmental disaster or meteorological disaster of one sort or another, whereas I think the smaller installations are a lot more, well, something there is going to be more resilient, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, there's a really big United Nations report published in, I think, two or three years ago now, just research across the board coming in saying, yeah, of course, a patchwork of localized systems with a wide variety of crops is much more resistant to disease, is much more resistant to random weather patterns. You're not going to have total failures, which is, of course, what we're facing with monoculture systems. The energy inputs of monoculture systems go up each year. You have to plow deeper and use more inputs, more fertilizers, more processing.
Bigger tractors.
The energy input just relentlessly goes up. Whereas with natural systems, the energy inputs go down. You know, you have to invest a lot at the beginning. This is a lot of what we've learned as well. We've got some really hard work to do over the next, period is, because starting these things off really does take a lot of work. You know, you don't get much yield. Planting thousands and thousands of little baby trees and get pretty much nothing back. But slowly, 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 the returns multiply and accelerate, get bigger and bigger, and the inputs go down each year.
And it is, of course, recognising a basic principle we've already talked about, which is that we're, as well as working for ourselves, we're working for others. And in those cases, we're really working for the next generation, aren't we, with small trees?
Essentially asset stripped the planet in pretty much 150 years. You know, so we haven't thought about next generations at all. We've just got, wow, bounty. Excellent. You know, have the lot all in one go. So, interesting thing. Setting the right things in place now that will create yields in future generations, we can be forgiven some of our worst sins by starting to do things right and thinking like that in longer time frames.
And if we were to do things this way, we'd be seeing more people in the countryside rather than fewer of them, which I also think is a good idea.
Yeah, I do. I do agree. And I think there's a real need to integrate a lot more people back into the countryside so that we can do much smaller scale farming and much different, you know, different kinds of cropping patterns and things like that. Because we will have to start managing rural areas with a view to sequestrating carbon and enhancing, protecting biodiversity. Because we cause a lot of damage. So we've got to start thinking about that. And that will involve more people in the countryside. In cities and in denser populations, though, you actually have a different set of opportunities and different set of challenges. But people grouped together can live quite efficiently because you don't need to do much transport. It's very easy to deliver services to those kinds of things. People who are densely populated together. And it's very easy to collect nutrients and water and compost things efficiently and stuff like that. And I think, again, we're never going to grow all of our food in cities and suburbs, but I reckon we could grow, you know, a significant amount. Be interesting to try. Certainly a quarter, that wouldn't be hard, you know. That would make a really different sort of thing to our townscapes as well. And we wouldn't have to collect refuse anymore because there wouldn't be any refuse. We'd be composting everything. And stuff that isn't compostable will either be too valuable to throw away or, you know, we shouldn't be using it. You know?
Again, nearly everything you see lying around is an opportunity of some sort.
Exactly that. Again, permaculture principle number 6 is produce no waste. But it goes on to really remind us that there is no such thing as waste. So waste, by its definition, is an unused opportunity. So you need to be looking at what's in the waste stream from any system and seeing that as, well, that's your raw material. That's what you got because no one else is smart enough to know how to use that. And waste can be occur in all sorts of different forms as well. So obviously not just wasting heat or wasting energy or wasting materials, but wasting experience or time or knowledge or forgetting to talk to older people before they die and downloading what they know. And these are all ways of wasting things, you know. And permaculture really encourages us to look into the waste stream, see it as opportunities and find ways to then turn those into yields and in a way which benefit you, benefit the people around you and in the long term of things, to help the environment. And this is the mindset that we need to be cultivating, certainly, if not in the current generation, but the upcoming generation, because this is the reality we are bequeathing them. Children, here's a climate-changed world with climbing CO2 levels and rapidly rising average temperatures. Good luck. I think we have to do more than that.
Yeah.
Look, there's been a lot of benefits from the industrial period. Let's not be unrealistic about that. We've all benefited from it in many ways. But actually, we didn't fully understand the consequences. This is how we're going to address it. This is how we're going to try and fix it. And in fact, being open about it.
And it is a change that can be made. I remember watching a YouTube video called The Power of Community about what happened in Cuba and Havana when they found themselves completely isolated from the West and the East. And one of the first things that happened was that Havana got turned into a huge market garden, basically. And it worked well for them, didn't it?
It did. I mean, what happened was that they struggled for 3 or 4 years because they really didn't know how to grow food. They weren't a farming population, so it's something that was outside of most people's experience, you know, and Cuba's collectivized, so, you know, the people weren't doing things for themselves. So they struggled a bit. But once they realized the basic principles of what they were doing, it was incredibly successful. The city of Havana was growing 70% of all its own food within a 10-kilometer reach of the radius of the city.
That's amazing, because one of the biggest objections I hear from people who aren't familiar with thinking in these terms is they imagine that cities are somehow immune to these benefits rather than actually potentially a focus that's more easily taken advantage of.
I actually see food growing and nutrient cycling essentially the same thing. They're just, you know, different parts of the same cycle. So it involves composting toilet waste and all organic matter and all of that stuff. It all needs to not be pumped miles away into sewage systems. It needs to be reincorporated into the soil very rapidly. And the person who's doing that makes it very, very easy to grow food. And that whole process, I actually think, should operate within the social economy. It shouldn't be anything to do with money or anything to do with farming or anything like that. It should be how we take care of old people, how we engage with young people, how we re-include excluded people back into our society, whatever form that takes, by involving them in that process. Taking out Mrs. Miggins' compost and turning out heap and, someone's got some apples down the road and making some chutney. That becomes part of how we care for children, you know, how we teach people to move and write, or, you know, and that all happens as a social function. And that maybe produces whatever. It doesn't matter how much, 30, 40, 50% of our food could come from there. Chickens running around and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
And the farmers can do the difficult stuff, and they can do the bread and the cooking oil and the whatever, you know, the stuff that's harder to do on a small scale.
I think that's another important point that could perhaps do with emphasising is the more of this stuff that can be made to be part of what we do, and the less it can have to do with money, the better, because that's probably the best way of making things cheap is to cut out all the middlemen and cut out the people who are simply doing it to make money out of it.
Well, we've kind of been encouraged to monetize every area of the economy. And a really simple example of that is it's now common to go and buy a coffee. Like, why would you commission somebody else to make a cup of coffee for you? It's not exactly difficult, is it? And we've generally got the wherewithal to do it within a pace away, you know, where, you know, I mean, occasionally you're out in town, sure, but, you know, just an example, but it's a silly example, but we've done it in every aspect of our life. We've outsourced it. We don't do anything ourselves anymore. We just, whatever it is, go and turn a particular handle part of the economy, you know, cranking out widgets or whatever to make money. And, it would be interesting to start to think about what are those things that we've outsourced that actually were kind of fun to do ourselves and bringing them back into the daily life again. And I think probably cooking could be the most important thing. Whether I thought it was a good idea to trust corporates with cooking for us. Where am I, you know?
No, you're not. We've noticed, when we've been wandering around the various towns we visit, stickers on some of the fast food takeaway shops saying, don't cook, just eat.
Yeah. I've obviously got it all wrong. Well, I've got, you know.
Oh, man.
I'd be doing it wrong, but you should have told me earlier, but,
No, I'm with you all the way. I you know, there's so many.
It suddenly, I mean, the idea of food banks appalls me. I mean, it's not right. And not least because food's not difficult to produce. Right now, our climate is in temperate climate, it rains all the time. We've got more resources than we have. Come on. Don't tell me people that, you know, that's just a symptom of very bad soil. And plus we've got lots of unused old people sitting in homes watching daytime TV, and we've got lots of unemployed young people. What? And food banks. Like, come on.
No. Can't we
join those dots together somehow? I mean, I feel like I've been talking to a brick wall for the last 5 years because it just seems so obvious to me that I've been, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Well, no, because I mean, I think it's a good point you made in your talk as well, that the food we are eating at the moment is not doing us any favours compared with such food as we would be growing ourselves, because obesity comes down largely to the fact that people are eating food that's supplied by the corporates rather than food they've grown. It'd be difficult, it would be seriously difficult for them to be getting into that kind of condition if they were eating mostly their own food.
I was chatting to Pip Waller the other day, who came to visit. She was also doing a talk at the But she did the Domestic Alchemist book and talks about all that sort of stuff. But yeah, she was talking, just chatting about food and health, and she said, you know, we are malnourished and overweight at the same time, you know, which is kind of an interesting paradox, but that's what industrialized and overprocessed food has done for us.
Another challenge that people, it's a strong one for me, is that people come up with is that it seems to be by and large assumed that what we do with our waste, I mean, you mentioned composting human waste. A lot of the people I talk to are totally horrified at doing that and seem to think that that dumping it all into previously cleaned water and then flushing it all away is the only way of doing it. Have you seen successful large-scale sort of humanure composting systems in your travels?
Well, a lot of the majority world, I suppose. I mean, there isn't enough fresh water in the world for everybody to have a flushing toilet. So if you think of it that way, you think, well, okay. It's not, you know, and fresh water is really in short supply. So again, questionable, whether they're a practice, you know, it's a questionable practice of using fresh water because the main reason there's water in toilets is to transport the waste away so we don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
It's that sort of closed mind. No, it's someone else's problem now. It's like a sloosh of, you know, blue scented water that smells like pine needles and, you know, vitreous white china. And it's like it's never happened, you know, and we can carry on with our lives as if such things don't exist. And pretending that things don't exist don't lead to a balanced understanding of the world. Because, as I say, food's as much about compost as it is about growing vegetables. You know, it's a whole cycle that produces it. And I think because we compartmentalize these things in our mind, it makes it hard to deal with them in the real world.
And it is actually it's potentially quite a miraculous stuff, isn't it? Composted human waste.
Why wouldn't it be? Because it's only the leftovers of the food that we ate, of the plants that we ate in the first place. It's only the same, the baked bread down biological byproducts of the very same thing, which is, and it's full of the very same organisms that are in the soil, that the soil needs to be able to digest those molecules to make them available to plants. So it's just completing, it's the basic building block of all natural systems. We only had to invent the toilet in the first place because when we moved from the countryside into the cities and all lived together, is you'll start getting typhoid. So you obviously, we didn't understand the transport of infectious diseases at the time either. So, you know, mistakes have been made, but how we responded to it, maybe it made sense at the time, but it doesn't really make sense at the time now, what we know now. Because, again, it consumes an enormous amount of resources. Pumping all that shit around, pardon my language, but that, you know, pumping all of that around the countryside, you know, that's all diesel. Pumping that's all contributing to climate change, global warming.
And
what we're going to say, everyone in India needs a flushing toilet? I don't think so. And I think the composting systems don't take any energy and obviously digest the pathogens, destroy the disease organisms, build healthy soil.
So have you, say, seen this being done successfully on a village, say a village scale anywhere?
I'm searching in my mind for a really good example. Cat was a good example. In the UK, Cat's a good example because that is a village scale community. The Centre for Alternative Technology in the Hunter. They're on a mixture of compost and reed bed systems. So they do have flushing toilets there, but none of them flush into a main sewer.
Okay.
Dealt with on site. So that's a good UK example. There's lots of examples around in the majority world, but unfortunately, yeah, they're not always, either they've been doing it for so long, for thousands of years, they don't need to talk about it because it's just embedded in their culture, so it works, or they're not doing it very well and it's being eroded by the arrival of modern technology, like flushing toilets. So, yeah.
So in the end, that's a wall we're likely to come up against, I reckon.
Yeah. But really, the thing is to get back is to, it's anything that burns diesel or, you know, burns oil, maybe uses electricity wastefully, we're going to have to look at it and reevaluate it. And pumping water around for sewage systems is one of those things that will have to be reevaluated.
I once heard that the sewers in London were originally built to supply water to the city rather than take waste out of it. I've never been able to look into that. Do you know anything about that?
I really don't.
But they have a left field question for you there.
It surprised me though, if you like, to hear that perhaps the design parameters of what they were thinking about when they built them is not how it is being used today. That's for sure. You know, how they're used currently is not what they were designed for originally, because the intensity of our use. Apparently, I mean, this is, I don't want to get into this, but apparently when they first started bringing in margarine and these saturated fats or polyunsaturated fats or hydrogenated oils, that's what it is, and they started getting blockages in the sewers.
Yeah.
That bit like artery, you know, a hardened artery. Mm. The deposits of all the fats or the rubbish that they were eating was kind of almost reappearing, you know, creating in the same pattern, but in the sewage network. It kind of alarmed me. And I get thinking about the change of how we use them to what they were designed for, you know.
Yeah. Oh, give me a composting loo any day, but I know there's a whole class of society who just won't go into them, no matter how nicely they're built,
sure.
Which is a bit odd.
You mentioned Peter Harper actually earlier from Cat, and actually I know him very well, and he was a colleague for many years, and yeah, he loves to be controversial. And he loves to.
I detected that from his article. Actually, I thought I think he deliberately knows he's using a big spoon here.
Yes, absolutely. And he wants permaculture to be better because he understands how important these things are. He doesn't like people just being lazy and making assumptions. He wants to go away and test your data and give me evidence and, you know, whatever. Anyway, he did interesting work where he ranked all of the kind of possible green solutions, all the kind of environmental things from changing light bulbs to compost toilets, right across the whole spectrum, and then got people to kind of vote for the things they thought were, you know, interesting or they might like to do. And yeah, guess what lost? By a long way.
The composting lose.
and that's because of the kitsch factor. That people actually don't like talking about toilets at the best of times, because the whole thing's a bit embarrassing. You don't really like to have to admit, you know, that you do it, let alone talk about it. And what we are culturally used to, you know, our flushing toilets is we don't have to think about it, and it's dealt with at a distance by someone else, you know. Whereas composting toilets bring you much more, you know, directly. You're dealing with it locally, so you're experiencing it locally, you know. Mm. And interestingly, you get over the kitsch factor, because I experience this all the time on my permaculture courses, so you introduce people to these ideas and all a bit, oh, I don't know. Mm. Within 2 or 3 days, it's already normal.
And what you get out of a composting toilet is actually not what you're putting in. This is what people seem to miss. I was amazed when I first saw what happens over a year, you know, if you leave one shut up for a year and then go to empty it out, it's not at all what you'd expect.
It's fully compost.
Mm.
It's something that's really pleasant.
Yeah.
And then that can be quite an aha moment for quite a lot of people who haven't fully thought through, you know, the realities of biology. It's seeing that, it's like, yeah, well, of course, you know, that is essentially soil. That's what we call it, soil. That is what soil is made out of. It's the fertile part of the soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously what you do is, compost is 25 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen. So what comes out of our body is quite rich in nitrogen. So to make it not foul and smell, you soak it into the nitrogen, whether it's urine or the solid waste, and you soak that into something that's very high in carbon. And the best thing is sawdust. And with a 25 to 1 carbon-nitrogen ratio, they physically, chemically combined together to create a stable molecule that doesn't smell.
And they do it really quickly as well.
It does. Very, very quickly, very actively. And then as it breaks down, you end up with final compost is about 10 carbon to 1 nitrogen. So it does. It's literally transformed in the process, but it stabilizes it and creates this very stable molecule that can sit in the soil for years and hold fertility there and do lots of useful things.
Mm.
As opposed to being something that's highly toxic and dangerous. And so, lots of energy to deal with.
Yeah, and leaves us with old pools of stuff that we don't really necessarily need about the place, as well as not actually cleaning it up very well on the way through. As far as I can gather from what I've read, the reed bed systems actually do a much better job.
They do.
And quality is another thing that I think is worthy of a mention here, because ideally you get better quality stuff and services as a result of thinking about it and getting involved.
I'm going to steer this conversation back to reference to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about economic systems. And I said, look, in our sort of free market systems, we're always externalizing the costs onto nature or onto society. in some way. And the way that we impact on the environment, we use nature as a soak for all of our toxins that we can't be bothered to deal with. And that happens in many, many forms. And only partly treated sewage is a good example of that. Pumping that into the sea or into water courses all the time. And then nature can fix it for us because it's very, you know, it's robust. But in doing that, we're, you know, we call it accelerating all the problems that we're causing and spreading our impact ever further. And unfortunately, yeah, we get to the stage where nature can't take much more anymore. And a real shift in that thinking has to happen. Again, permaculture is hopefully a process that can help facilitate that happen and enable us to have these dialogues and these discussions rationally and not hysterically.
Yeah. It gives us context to have those conversations and a place where we can practically experiment. So I guess what we're saying is that permaculture is not just a set of ideas, that the actual real essence of the thing is actually in the application of those ideas and in taking... and in taking advantage of the opportunities that arise as a result of constant change.
Yeah. And because we accept that, we recognise that things are constantly changing, so it means that any response that I might initiate, you know, whatever it is, any plan I might execute to plant my an abundant garden or to redesign your whatever, or, you know, save the world from climate change, that any response that I do isn't going to be perfect. And it might be, as long as it's more or less right, it's okay, get on with it. But observe and interact. So where it isn't quite working, make changes. And then to keep steering it, because things are constantly changing. There is no single answer.
But that in itself kind of engages creative faculties that people don't always have a chance to use nowadays.
Absolutely. I think we're kind of encouraged to think we need to know all of the outcomes before we engage on something. Otherwise, we're being reckless. And it's like, well, okay, if you're building a bridge, maybe, or, you know, like something really complicated, then, yeah, it's probably good to have, you know, real detailed plans. But, you know, if you're going to glide, whatever, what's the worst going to happen, you know? Just get things in perspective.
Yeah.
And give yourself full permission to get on with those things that aren't going to be fatal if they go wrong, you know. Just as long as you're paying attention, as long as you accept feedback and make changes.
And do you find it is, yeah, yeah, accept feedback. I like that one. And apply self-regulation.
Yes. That's your steering mechanism. So if you don't pay attention, then you'll definitely fall off your bike at some point, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you find that, before we go for a bit of a music break, do you find that, people are motivated to action by your courses? Because you've done a lot of them now. I mean, best part of 30 over the years. You must have had a lot of people, past your desks, as it were.
Yeah, it does feel so, like that. And I think it is good, and I'm constantly hearing back from people who, you know, use the ideas in all sorts of different ways. So yes, but at the same time, it's not in a sort of self-congratulatory way, but it's more that I'm looking at it is how can we make this more effective? How can we actually need to be able to accelerate, you know, like the responses and positive change and, you know, the permaculture ideas and things need to kind of accelerate out there. So, how do we do that? You know, what can we learn from what we've done thus far to be more effective at it? So I'm trying to use what feedback we get to be much more effective. So we don't have much time, you know, in terms to start making big differences now.
And in that sense, anything that really seeks to or successfully manages to initiate action and move people from thinking to actually doing stuff is good news.
It is. And to actually start giving people really positive sort of good news messages, not in an unrealistic way, but in like, you know, we really can do stuff about climate change, we really can do stuff about environmental degradation and destruction, and the most important thing to do is start, like, composting things, and start, you know, building the soil around you, and even if you can't do that, get to know your neighbours, just, you know, get to know yourself a bit more, start from what you've got, think about what you know, and, you know, find out a bit more about what's going on. These are all things that we can do, and instantly give you a positive feedback, instantly make you feel a little bit more positive or, you know, a bit more empowered or energised.
And we'll open up, if you're interrelating with other people, in my opinion, it will inevitably result in other opportunities arising.
Yeah.
Because that's where they come from. They come from interactions with other people.
It's really true. Somebody, I mean, I don't want to keep going on about climate change and the Paris summit and everything, but obviously the media has been full of it for the last few weeks, and it is a significant thing. But I was reading an article, one person's take on it, and they said, you know, it was a bit like being at Woodstock, you know, not in terms of, you know, whatever, drugs and rock and roll, but it felt like a significant watershed cultural moment where people were together going, actually, you know, being collectively excited by a new set of possibilities.
Well, what do you think is likely practically to come out of the Paris conference?
I think the treaty that they signed isn't really worth the paper that they've written it on, because it's nowhere near enough and nowhere near fast enough and all that sort of stuff. But this goes back to the thing, look, this isn't going to be a top-down process. This is going to be a bottom-up process. This change that needs to happen. We'll have to take it on personally. We have to start remodeling our own lives in a low-carbon way. So Paris and what they just signed gives us full permission to do that. If you were waiting to get that little chitty in the post saying, yes, go for it, you just got it.
I think the other permission we're likely to see is that it's quite clear around here that the County Council are going to stop spending money on absolutely anything. So I'm sure they'll be more than happy to have a bit of mowing taken off their hands in exchange.
Well, that's right. They're going to have to stop doing the silly things that cost lots of energy and don't yield anything, like, yeah, pointlessly mowing.
Mowing grass.
Mowing grass. Driving around trash and stuff. And, you know, those kind of things. It's totally non-productive and costs an awful lot of money. And suddenly if you're forced to having streetlights on all night, do we really need that everywhere, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many areas which we can make really big and fast gains on, but only if you unleash the power of the individual to innovate, because the Paris County Council or whoever aren't going to sit and come up with all the ideas.
They certainly ain't going to innovate.
No.
Far from it.
But no, look, you have full permission, as does everybody else, on that bit of paper that they just signed, say, go for it, create your low-carbon future. And it's not something you can buy. It's not a consumerist thing. You can't go and queue up at Walmart and buy, I'd like to buy my low-carbon future, please. You've got to create it.
Yeah.
And it's got to be one that meets your needs first, that makes you happy, so you want to carry on creating it.
Well, that's nice.
If it isn't a Dr. Shop rock-shaped universe that you're creating, then you're not going to love it that much, are you?
I don't think anybody would want one of them.
Well, just you a little bit of it.
Yeah, it's not nice to know.
You know what I mean?
Nice to know that the men in the suits are at least appearing to hand power back to the people who actually know what to do with it. Look, I'll put on 7 or 8 minutes of music, and we'll have a wee break, and then come back.
Do you want to call me back, or should I hang up?
Yeah, why not? Hang up and I'll call you when the next track's playing, and okay. we'll come back with a chat hopefully about community and cooperative living, because I think that's something else that seems to be seriously marginalised. But
absolutely. I look forward to speaking again.
Brilliant. Thanks for being there, Steve. I'll talk to you in a few minutes. So that's Steve Jones talking to me there about permaculture and about changes that we hope to see in individuals and in the landscape around us. And it's, I think, always good to hear somebody else saying that really the change has got to start with us. We need to get practically involved. And this is a kind of grassroots, if you'll pardon the pun, this is a kind of grassroots thing that we can get involved in. And, which I do see being encouraged around me in more and more places. And, it does have to be said, the food tastes a lot better when you grow it yourself. Anyway, here's Thin Lizzy and Dancing in the Moonlight. I don't think we've had this one before, probably. There we go. That's the Fun Loving Criminals and Smoke 'Em, and before that, Dancing in the Moonlight from Thin Lizzy. And now I'm rejoined on the line by Steve Jones. Thanks for being there again, Steve.
Yeah, you're welcome. Great to be here.
And, I'm hoping now to talk a little bit about the housing cooperative side of your expertise and experience, because, we've been travelling around various communities for 4 years or so, and probably a bit longer, really, if the truth be told.
Yeah.
And, have yet actually to come across an active co-op, and I'm aware that you've really been living in sort of shared projects or cooperatives for a while, haven't you?
20 years is a little bit frightening to say, but no, it's a big subject, isn't it? But we talked about the social aspect of permaculture, and I think this is a really, really big important bit when it comes to start thinking about economic institutions and things like whatever, putting together businesses and housing co-ops or whatever, is if we're going to do that in a cooperative, non-hierarchical way, then actually we need really good people skills and really good tools for making decisions and resolving conflicts and differences and misunderstandings and all that sort of stuff, and to do that in a, you know, mutually respectful, non-destructive way. And in our culture, we are not rich in those concepts and skills, really.
Yeah, I ain't arguing with that.
Yeah. And most people, when you start talking about cults, will react by, ooh, I couldn't live with other people. Ooh, no. Ooh, as if that would be the worst thing that could ever happen. You see, well, they might be nice people, and they might make life a little bit easier, not a little bit harder. But, yeah. So I think, yeah, it is a big subject. But obviously, the more that we could come together to agree to share certain assets, shall we say, then again, things become a lot easier and cheaper. So, you know, really simple examples is every house in your average suburban street got what a lawnmower in their shed that they use once a week, if that, and, you know, a washing machine they use a couple of times a week, and a car they, you know, sits there for half of its life. And all these things that we hardly ever use that we're constantly paying for. You could just share a few of those, that would make life a lot easier, wouldn't it? And you organize yourself into little communities. You can still live in your same house and have your same degree of personal privacy that you are used to, but you could share some of these facilities. And you could pull a car or two, or share a washing machine, or, you know, gardening tools, or Xboxes, or whatever, all the hedge trimmers, you know, whatever, all the things that we, the clutter of life. It starts to open up new possibilities.
And that's something that I think, again, really deserves a bit of emphasis, because I've been living in shared houses, certainly since, more or less, since I left home.
Yes.
And I'm aware that my overheads have been hugely lower than most of my compadres. And it's really great occasionally to have somebody else to do the cooking and occasionally somebody else to do the washing up or whatever. It's actually, again, like you say, the people skills are really quite important. We'll probably get into that a bit, but it as long as you've got those, it really is a much, much easier way to live. And it strikes me as very odd that we've all been separated, so we have to do it all for ourselves.
Well, we've kind of fallen for the trap a little bit, and, you know, but look, so the basic formula is this, you know, the bigger the house, the cheaper it is per room. So if there's a lot of you, a 22-bedroom, £6 million mansion suddenly it becomes affordable if there's enough people, you know, that sort of thing. The most expensive way to live is a person alone in a flat, you know, per head capita. And it's the same for using resources. It becomes a very inefficient way of living, and, you know, heating a whole space for one person. So, yeah, if we could share a bit and get a bit better at working together, then suddenly we have enormous possibilities.
And I think, again, something that's not immediately obvious is that as a result of sharing basic things like that and getting on with it, a lot of other things tend to become shareable as well. Life, basically, for me, has been a lot easier, I think, because of the people I've been spending time with. You've got,
yes,
instead of spending time with yourself, which I can sometimes find a bit alarming, you do have the option of spending time with other people and, you know, hammering a bit of stuff out.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, it's just in so many ways, whatever, the exchange of whatever skills and knowledge and you know, just that simple thing of doing something by yourself is, you know, can be three times as hard. You have someone to hold the ladder or pass you the bucket or whatever it is that you know, simple tasks that you do. It just become much, much more easier.
Mm.
You don't have to give up personal space, what we call kind of zone one space in permaculture, but that really personal space is very hard to share with other people. You don't have to let people all the way into your bedroom just to be able to share a lawnmower with them. Or, you know,
I think that's
mutually, you know, care for an orchard or something.
Yeah, I think that's another good point, is that I think that one of the most critical elements in living successfully in community is in having, for everybody to have some private space. I think it's pretty critical, really.
Absolutely key. No, because, yeah, that's right, that's where we really need that personal space. And then, so look, if you allow yourself to invest into yourself, right, so that, you know, you need a good night's sleep and a good breakfast and a decent pair of boots and all that sort of stuff, right, and there you are, kitted out and ready to go for the new day. And then you're enabled, and all that stuff happens on within your zone one, which is your home. And then as you go out to your community, zone two or zone three, the world of work, you're then able to interact with those and contribute to them because you yourself have been empowered in your own private space. When all these things get confused and overlapped, and yeah, it gets complicated. And that's the bit where people become disinclined to want to share, you know?
I think it is the disinclination to share, I think, is something that's encouraged at every turn by our mass media and other sources.
And it suits the marketing guys, doesn't it? They get more people to sell red brick boxes to or whatever, you know, sell lawnmowers to. They're going to break in, whatever, 3 years or something. But it's a radical thing, actually. Don't think we could share. It's become almost an act of revolution.
It's amazing, isn't it? It is, yeah, you're right. It is a radical, well, it, you know, just from precedent set about me, I see it's a common thing. Although, yeah, people are willing to share round here, I think a bit, but it's not the same as actually having, I often think what it would be like if instead of going and forming festival crews just for festivals, if we actually had a base from which we could do such things, we'd be able to do it a lot more effectively and develop things over the year and all that kind of stuff. The kind of, potential not only for living more cheaply but for greater creativity as a result of having more free time is also an important aspect.
That's really, really important. And again, it's, if you can sort of decouple yourself from the mortgage machine somehow, and then that allows you to decouple yourself from the treadmill that goes along with feeding that, you know, if you can reduce your living costs so perhaps you can afford to work only, you know, 4 days, 3 days a week, then the quality of your life shifts. Once you're only working 3 days a week, then you've got 4 days to do the good stuff, the majority of your time. You know, that's an amazing position to get to if you can get to that. But even to have just a bit, to, okay, this is actually the definition of permaculture. There's three core ethics to it. One's about understanding the impact of everything you do that has on living systems and a lot of stuff to do with that. We call that earth care. There's a lot of stuff around other people and how we do things, you know, how things, decisions that we make impact on other people and how we work with other people to be effective and call that people care. But those are really, really big areas and very, very important. The thing that actually defines whether it's permaculture is the third ethic. And it asks you this key question, is what do you do with surplus? And what that means is you have to accept that at some point we say, okay, you've got to meet your needs first, so you need some breakfast and you need a good night's sleep and a decent pair of boots or whatever it was I said earlier. So you meet your needs. But at some point, how many pair of boots do you need? You know, you can decide. You need two, you need three, you need five, but at some point, you've got enough. You don't need any more. So then the critical question becomes, what do you do with the bit that's left over? You know, what do you do with the surplus? And that's the bit. If you constantly reinvest that in the other people and the planet, then things start to get better. That's the very process of what defines it. It's that constant reinvestment of surplus, that constantly using that bit of energy, a bit of time, a bit of money, a bit of resource that you've got left over when you met your own needs. What you do with that defines, if you like, that's your mechanism to make things, to steer things in the right direction.
I think living in a community also helps. There's more likely to be somebody close to you who actually needs the thing that you don't need currently.
Well, that's right. And also it's more likely that there to be some kind of a surplus because you're not trying to do everything yourself. If you can share within community, whether it's within housing co-op or whether it's just sharing stuff with your neighbours and people around you, is reduce living costs, right? So then there's more possibility for surplus and it gives you more chance to, you know, they talk about, it's this really simple idea, and it's at the heart of community building. Is, you know, you take a bit of time out to grow some vegetables to feed yourself, right? So you grow your runner beans, and you have a bumper crop, and you've eaten yourself, you've frozen them, you made some jam out of them, you've whatever, got a fridge full of bean chutney or whatever, and you've still got some left. What do you do with them? You give them to your neighbour. And with that, you get to know them a bit. Or, you know, you have a party with them. They've been throwing their beans and eat beans. But, you know, these are the things that we build community on, right? And it's that mechanism. So the more we can meet our needs collectively through community and create some kind of surplus, the more then we can continue to invest in that process, and the more it develops, and the more interesting and the more interconnected it becomes, which again is kind of what natural systems do.
Yeah. So you must have developed over your 20 years or seen developed or helped to develop some systems for dealing with the major challenges, which I think you identified very effectively at the beginning of this second chat, which are your people skills, how to make decisions and how to resolve conflicts. Where did all of it start for you? Was Chicken Shack your first?
Chicken Shack was the first housing cooperative, but what I had experienced before that, and that started 20 years ago. We just celebrated 20th anniversary of that, and that was quite a big milestone. But I worked on lots of community projects before that, and some of which were extremely dysfunctional. And although they were kind of fun, and we learned lots, but, you know, to learn lots, you need to make a lot of mistakes, and we made a lot of mistakes. And it gave me a lot of insight at the time into perhaps what you might need, you know, how you might actually be a bit more successful. And you need a plan, and you need to have a kind of a common vision that goes, that's beyond just yourself. And you can't do things by yourself, so you've got to recognize from the outset that you've got to work with other people if you want to achieve things, you know, beyond yourself. And we flailed around for a couple of years with just ideas, but not really having any sense of how to put a co-op together and how to structure it and how to make decisions. And the thing that made the difference between just being us talking about it and us doing it was joining networks. We became regular radical route attendees of their quarterly meetings. We met other people with similar interests who were at a similar stage of development to us. We shared notes, you know, we supported each other. We realized, you know, just educated each other on how to do it, you know. None of it's complicated, but it's still a process. You need to learn how to write business plans. You need to learn, you know, how to write, have minute, meetings and minutes. You need to know the kind of the right language for how to speak to a bank and stuff like this. It's not that difficult. And once you set it up, then you get a new challenge, which is then managing it, which is a very different set of challenges from putting one together. So the big lesson was about a lot of what we got from medical research and from permaculture is having rules and having a plan so that everybody, you have to be democratic. If you can't share information effectively amongst everybody, then you're not going to be democratic. So then you're going to create all these tensions over time.
How many rules did you find you had to have?
Not many. In fact, the best rules that I've come across, and after many years of doing this, are the seven principles of cooperation, which has come from the Rochdale pioneers, the people who invented cooperatives in 1876, or it was, and the principles and ethics of permaculture. If you put those two together and say that's basically our model rules, and you join that together with the standard model rules for housing co-op, which already been written, then you've got a really good operating system. And you just kind of stick within that structure, and it gives you a good start. But the lesson, what I've learned from it, and it hasn't been easy, and it's been challenging, and been all sorts of ups and downs, is you have to continually invest in the process, which goes back to the investing surplus, which means that each new member of the co-op, you actually have to take some time out to explain to them properly how it works, and give them access to the information, and yourself as well, but keep occasionally, whatever, through networking or training, but keep reinvesting in the process because skills decay over time. You need to keep re-energizing them and reinvesting them. And what happens to really successful co-ops is they're successful, and years go by, and they become, over time, isolated because they don't really need the networks, so they can survive outside of them. And then when they get to the point that they have a problem, maybe the members that had those best skills aren't there anymore, or, you know, aren't as functional as they used to be, or, you know.
So the lesson is
you need to network and you need to keep reinvesting in the democratic processes, otherwise you'll end up in trouble at some point.
So it's a kind of living organism then, really.
Absolutely. And they have a life of their own, absolutely do. And yeah, know what, you can't be in control of it, you can only steer it. It's the same with like having a baby, isn't it? As soon as you... It has a life of its own, so you can influence it, but you can't control it, you know?
Yeah. I think it's a telling thing, isn't it? That one of the things that really kick-started it and kick-started making it work was actually networking with other people, which is one of the basic lessons of the whole thing, isn't it?
It really was. And we got to the point where we realised we didn't know enough to be able to do it, and we had to go and ask other people.
So who are Radical Roots?
They're a secondary co-op. So they are a network of co-ops that have chosen to network with each other, and they each send a delegate to a meeting once a quarter, and that meeting is Radical Roots, whoever it is who attends it, and they make the business decisions for that quarter. So it's a secondary organisation that doesn't employ anybody, it doesn't really exist outside of the membership of the member organisations.
So that's quite clever.
It is very clever, and it survived. It's been going for, 25 years or something, and it's still surviving. It's got different people involved in it now, so it is interesting how it's worked. And it operates a little bit like a credit union. They help people raise deposit money to start off the co-op, because you don't have any money of your own, then you need something to start the ball rolling, start fundraising with, and they can help you do that with soft loans that they persuaded other people to invest through them into new co-ops. It's a very much a mutual self-help ethos is embedded within it.
And this is also presumably provides a means by which things that have been learnt can be transmitted.
Absolutely. So it can kind of not keep, yeah, learn the lessons that have been, you know, yeah, along the way, and not forgetting them and keep having to repeat them, which is what happens a bit. So,
yeah, that's yeah, another...
I'm involved now in my third co-op. I've helped another group set up as well, so I've sort of had a hand. So I sort of feel very close to four or five different co-ops actually over that time, and they've all had really, you know, bountiful periods, and they've had challenging periods. But what I would like to do next, looking at it, is I'd like to build a stronger sort of radical reach type network, but that's much more regional. Because before, yeah, the weakness of radical reach is it's UK national organisations. So going to their quarterly meetings means sometimes going to Scotland or Cornwall or London or whatever, the four corners of the UK. whereas, and that was the reason why, eventually, when we didn't really need it, at Chicken Shack, we stopped being members because there's a long way to get to the meeting. That was our first co-op. And now here I find myself 20 years later thinking, yeah, actually we need to recreate that, but perhaps something that's more local and that would enable us to support each other and share learning and also help raise funds when they're needed and hold work days and celebration days and, you know.
Well, I guess the principle of the thing's been established, hasn't it? And now what you can have is some smaller nodes on your network. Because again, localizing things is one of our main interests, isn't it?
Yeah, these are like fractal patterns, aren't they? They work at every scale. And I think that's, again, the challenge is to reinvent that national network, but for more local. And the more that people can do that, the more we can, you know, well, that can happen in different regions, and the more we can support more people to start new co-ops, you know. And with the current attitude, investment patterns, you know, let's not get too much into just mudslinging things about politics and stuff, but, you know, they're not investing in social housing anymore. In fact, they're encouraging, they want to sell off even the housing association. So it does beg the question, is where are these people going to live, who haven't got on this fabled, housing ladder? And different ways of owning and managing property. Surely, this is conversations that should be happening much more regularly. And I'm not saying that my experience of housing costs certainly isn't the only way to do it, but it's very important to be putting out the message out there to say there are other ways of doing it. You don't have to do a private mortgage thing. You don't have to have capital. There are other ways to own and manage property.
What sort of other ways have you explored?
Well, I'm saying the co-op models, but I mean, so my personal experience is a fully mutual housing co-op, which is the Radical Roots model, what they told us about 20 years ago. And the formula that we used to set up all four of the housing co-ops that I've been involved in and are all still going. That's what I most know about. But there are lots of other ways of doing it. There are community land trusts. You might have heard about them. Where perhaps you set up a cooperative that owns the land. And then if you're perhaps going to do a self-build project and you can get planning permission, then the value of that land is going to suddenly change from agricultural to building plots. And all of that money, that value, has been created by, you know, somebody signing a planning consent form. Instead of that going into somebody's pocket and driving up the prices of houses, that value is held by a cooperative, which never sells it. So it's just a book value. It doesn't create inflation anymore.
It's a bargaining chip, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. It's another way, again, say there are other models or other ways to create affordable housing that could be led by tenants and by groups of people, you know, rather than necessarily by local authorities or private companies. It's a very, very versatile model and could be applied in lots of different ways. And especially if you could get, you know, certain banks and things more closely involved in it, you could find an investment for it too. And we could do these things if we were defining how new habitations and things were designed and developed, especially if we were involved in permaculture, they'd all be zero carbon. Because that's fairly easy to do. The government would seem to be able to do it, but they've just revoked all the building regulations. But actually, as soon as you start working with natural materials and low energy systems and closed loop nutrient systems, they become very, very cheap to build and to run.
That's another thing, isn't it, about having several people around you as these projects are become actually achievable.
Yeah, it's like no one's done yet. So it's hard to have the skill set that can encompass all of these things. But as soon as you start operating as a community, then yeah.
And there's a lot of mobile skill sets available, especially I've been quite surprised at the growth in alternative buildings. There are people who really do know about straw bale building who'll come and help out.
Absolutely. And there's lots of, yeah, some very energized young people out there from right across Europe on the WOOF circuit and all those other volunteer circuits, just desperate to get experience as well. I think there's a lot of youth, unemployed youth in Europe who are just gagging, you know, they've been well educated, smart kids, they just haven't had the opportunity to do anything. And, we can create these opportunities very easily if, only we, you know.
They're fabulous people to have around as well. I've had a lot of experience over the last couple of years of people volunteering on the WOOF scheme, and we have met a non-stop stream of really well-motivated, really interestingly enabled young people. Not exclusively young, but mostly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, they happen to, yeah, certainly don't have to be, but I'm really pleased to hear you, yeah, say that, give back that positive experience, because I think that is most people's experience. And sometimes, you know, the odd bad volunteer can put people off, but in principle, now there's a fantastic energy out there, people are hungry for experience. And
it means effectively that if you want to get, I mean, I know the straw build quite often runs on the model where they say, well, look, if you want a straw bale build on your place, what we'll do is we'll run a course there. And so a load of people come and help them effectively. Somebody makes a few gaming tokens out of it. You get your straw build and lots of people meet lots of other people to work with again in the future, hopefully.
That's right. I mean, the downside of this, let's just say the reality of working with natural building materials, is it ends up being a hell of a lot of labour. lots and lots of people doing things. And if you've got to pay for that properly, then it makes it expensive. But you can unleash that magic of community energy and volunteers and work experience and courses and all that sort of stuff. And then suddenly, yeah, these things are really doable.
That's exactly right. And just that activity in itself massively reduces the cost of things, largely because you're removing the currency from it as far as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it, you know, if you get good at things like cooking and you realize you can feed 20 people, at, you know, not much harder than feeding 3 or 4, and it doesn't have to cost very much at all, you know.
That's, of course, another side to it, is that you don't just get to do the work, whatever it is. You do get a vast amount of social activity out of it as well, and it's constantly changing. Rather than always dealing with the same people and talking about the same things, it's new practically every night.
Yeah, and actually this is exactly the experience and the vibe of things that we create on our permaculture courses. You know, do these 2-week residential courses where people come and engage with all the issues and give them the kind of design model and the sort of template. But we live in that reality, in that sort of shared community reality for the whole of the 2 weeks, that we're all, you know, cooking and caring for each other and, you know, whatever, and, you know, doing all the maintenance tasks of our little camp all together, you know, and you just slowly involve, you know, we'll have a little crew of people that help do it. And as the course progresses, we just involve all the participants in it as well. So by the end, you know, there's no staff, there's no pupils, all just in it together, you know.
Yeah, Synchro and I did visit the last one, the last residential one you ran, on the final, more or less, well, the penultimate night, I think it was, and it was, even though we didn't know most of the people there, it was like coming home, even for us, and it felt great. People seemed to be very, very happy, and they were all really busy as well.
That's it, yeah, so it is, this is a natural state of being for people, isn't it? Just to be socially engaged and being a little bit useful, but just chatting whilst you're doing a bit of washing up or helping prepare the food whilst, you know, learning, whilst keeping an eye on the, you know, just, yeah, life, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, something that not a lot of people actually get a chance to experience.
You know, it's actually true. It is true. Sometimes, you know, I find myself chatting about these kinds of things to people quite a lot. And sometimes people say, oh, come on, all these things you're saying, it's no big deal, it's just common sense.
I'm not sure about common
sense. Well, yeah, do you know what? I mean, yeah, it is. But do you know what? Common sense isn't that common anymore, you know? It's like to say, permaculture is applied common sense. Because all the things that we kind of know that we still aren't doing. And we've got, at some point, we've got to turn these things into action. And, yeah, apply that common sense.
Yes. I think that everybody's common sense is different. 20-odd years in industry taught me that common sense, whilst it might be quite common, everybody's version of it was slightly different.
That's also true. I mean, that's also really true. But that's all the wonderful part of the whole diversity of the human family, you know? Mm. And sometimes we're just plain wrong. And that's also, you know, and that can be one of the greatest challenges in life, actually, is to have the humility to get over these things, you know?
Well, they're going to happen, aren't they? That's the thing. Yeah. It seems to me to be an overwhelming willingness to try and apportion blame for when stuff is, shit's going to happen every now and then. You know, and sure. you do have to just kind of shake it off your boots and move. Learn from it, because you can always learn from the bad ones.
But looking, suddenly chasing after people to blame isn't necessarily the best response. It's not in the middle of a crisis. But, and that does worry me that if we hit some kind of energy crisis or environmental kind of, you know, edge, is the responses aren't going to be very smart, because we're going to be all reacting in, you know, strange indirect ways, because we'll be blaming the wrong people. Then we keep saying, well, the economy's malfunctioning because, it's not raining, or something, you know. Or just being angry at Tesco's when their business model goes pop and they're not there anymore.
It's one of the reasons for trying to start moving in these directions, isn't it? Is because, if there's already somebody travelling that way, there's more likely to be other people who join in.
Yeah. That's very true. And I think the most important thing, the very least what we should be doing, is preparing ourselves emotionally and intellectually for the challenges that lie ahead. Because in that way, at least, we might have a chance of kind of reacting in the right way and in appropriate, useful ways. Because we don't know what form the shocks are going to come, but they're going to come. Whether it's rolling blackouts or, you know, the energy is fine, but the climate goes weird, or, you know, that something, you know, whatever, economic, we could have a huge banking collapse again tomorrow. We don't know. But the system's so stretched that something somewhere could go crack, and we need to respond to that appropriately. Not waste our energy running around panicking.
And, which is why I think, a sort of generic solution such as building community and trying to rebuild our environment around us is so helpful, because it kind of doesn't matter what sort of challenges are going to arise. We will deal with them better if we manage to deal with those two first.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And you begin to actually know each other a little bit, or have these connections, or have some of the infrastructure in place that you need to go forward, you know, begin to recognize. Again, permaculture, the whole design process, which is the third part, you know, the ethics, the principles, and then the design process. The design process starts with a survey. So you don't rush around doing things straight away. What have we got? What do we need to do? What are the limiting factors? How urgent is it? Let's think about that, so you've actually got some kind of a sense of a strategy in place.
You're looking at broadly what it is you want to do and what order you're going to do it in, as far as you can tell at the beginning.
Yep. And what have we got to do it with?
Yep. And I agree that
lots of things that we need and don't have, and then go, well, we can't do anything because we don't have the things we need. If you look at the things you need, how can we use those to deliver whatever response we choose to do?
That's something that struck me about people like yourself who've worked in foreign countries, is how when you haven't got access to garden centres and things where you can just pop out and buy stuff, you have to rise.
The option is to generate them yourself.
Yeah.
Possibly
a difficult question off the top of your head, but what are the most interesting solutions you stumbled across when faced with challenges like that?
It's amazing the ingenuity of people, and you realise, of course, that embedded in this sort of cultural memory are all these ways of doing things that we have forgotten because we've got machines, you know. So, what I remember, it's a very good example or not, but what I remember was digging a huge hole for a sort of septic tank, for a soakaway system for a bathroom that we're building on a traveller's lodge in a remote place in Zimbabwe years ago. And the pit that we were excavating was like a massive boulder in there. And we're like, oh God.
Isn't there always?
And we just really were like stumped, didn't know what we were going to do about it, and kind of gave up and went off to the pub or whatever, and came back, whether it was a few days later, to look at the job again, and it wasn't there. It was gone. It was this massive boulder, and it was gone from this big hole that we'd dug. It was like, how the hell? Well, that's impossible. And then we went and spoke to the guys, you know, we were working with, what happened to the hole? And they said, well, we put a fire on it, and then poured water on it, and broke into bits, and took it away. Right. How else do you move a stone? They looked at us blankly. It's like, I can't even thought of that.
That's true. That's a very, very ancient solution, isn't it? I'd forgotten about that one.
We would have got a machine or something. We would have got the tractor and used a gallon of diesel trying to get it out.
Once again, nice demonstration of how the learning is always two-way. The teacher is also a pupil.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the knowledge that you need is usually just around you. If only you can listen to the people around you, you know, accept feedback.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Probably, I don't know how people hear this, but to a lot of ways it sounds very detached and very idealistic or something, but actually it isn't. Permaculture is really pragmatic. It doesn't require you to believe anything. It just tells you to observe what's actually happening around you all the time, and especially what happens when nature's just left to do its own thing. And just to start to see what patterns you can see in that and apply it to whatever situation you're in. And yeah, it's not an abstract thing. It's a very real thing that everyone can do, you know.
And as we were saying earlier, by choosing to start paying that kind of attention, you're actually making a difference.
Absolutely. That in itself already makes a big difference.
Once you start interacting as well as a result of what you've been watching, then that makes further changes.
Yeah. In one of his talks, one of the permaculture word was kind of coined by two guys, an Australian forester called Bill Morrison, and a student of his who comes into the ecology called David Holmgren. And they wondered about what would it take to create a sort of permanent culture. You know, you'd have to have a really deep understanding and live within the rules of ecology, so kind of flow from all of that. David Holmgren was also very interested in change and transition and how we bring about change. And he says this, and this is really interesting about the personal choice thing. He says that, you know, if you look at the kind of Western, predominantly white, not exclusively, but the Western kind of middle class people, you know, right across from me, including Japan and whatever, and emerging middle classes in India and America, Europe, but just think about that, like, group of people. You know, we're part of it. In one form, the board says, we've all been to whatever, had education, healthcare, and we've been beneficiaries of the system, right? And that's only whatever it is, 3 or 4% of the total market. But there are people who are really engaged and connected and dynamic and intelligent and you know, well invested in. If those 3 or 4% of people start collectively to behave differently, like, that's a significant change in terms of, markets. Segmentation or something like that, you know, the way that, you know, the suits, the way that money sees things, that's a significant change. And if it's the empowered white middle classes, you know, globalized, you know, that middle group of people that shift very rapidly from away from coal, gas and oil towards wind and solar and straw bale houses and all that sort of stuff, that in itself creates a highly significant kind of, you know, market signal ripple right across the globe, you know.
Well, it does have to be
people
said that...
People have never been as empowered as that group of people, you know.
And these are exactly the kind of people who tend to follow what the hippies do first.
Yeah.
You know, we are seeing a growth in this sort of thing that's quite rapid now.
For sure. You know, look, so I said something earlier about how in permaculture we're really interested in edges. And it's really interesting to see how a forest advances into a savanna and what the plants and things you go on those edges. But think about social edges. You talked about the hippies getting there first. Well, it's a kind of a social edge, is that the people with free access to information who aren't heavily invested in old ideas or belief systems or who are able to think new thoughts, those are the early adapters. Those are the people who bring change with them. They occupy that new territory first, you know? Which is exactly what happens in the new ecosystem that's presented. The most hardy, adaptable, you know, species turn up first. And it might be in the form of lichens or whatever, or it's on a new piece of rock. But, you know, the analogy works in lots of different ways. And then those species, you know, they colonize that space. They also civilize that space. They soften it slightly. They live and die. Their body forms soil. And like you're saying, our lives create soil. So, and in that process, a broader spectrum of species start coming in. And they're slightly less hardy and slightly less adaptive and slightly less responsive to new ideas, but they're still occupying that new territory. We're right on the edge now, into that where the next real sector of society has been brought into that way of thinking. Is, look, you know that this coal, gas, oil thing is coming out to an end. You know it. You know it. And no matter how invested in it you are, you know in your heart of hearts you're a smart enough person to realize that, you know. And then that's the center ground take, you know, that's just a shifting the central balance of the whole of the global economy, just from that little shift.
Yeah.
And I think that's happening right now, and the fact that middle classes are struggling so much in the post-crash world as well.
Many of them have got plenty of room to grow some veg.
Yeah.
Actually, Rick's put very, very apropos statement in the chat box. Rick Fields has put it. It amazes me when you switch off from all the MSM crap and turn back to nature, you find how wise you are and find others as wise as you and how you all connect, which I think is a great summary of it.
That's a very good point. It is, it's like that taking that time out to listen and disconnecting from the chatter. And then you start to get that feedback and maybe you realize it's a kind of dialogue you've always been involved in. We're all experts in our own.
And you have to explore your imagination as well, don't you? I remember you saying that the only limit to this really is our imagination in a time of great change.
Yes. And to dare to think out of the box. So we really need to think out of the box. And again, go back to the Paris summit. It's telling you, think out of the box, people, you know, come up with some different ideas because the current ones are working.
We've run out of money.
It worked for a while, but we've done that now.
Yeah, we've run out of money. It's your turn to have a go.
Yeah. It's okay. So you have to always, you know, whatever, just keep rising. Interesting times. But so I think, look, we all have our dark days, but I think really is, I like to say I'm a professional optimist. You know, it's my job to say, it's all right, folks. We can do this. Nature's incredibly resilient, incredibly powerful. It just wants to rebuild complexity. It wants to rebuild soils. We just have to kind of let it. We have to address, identify the limiting factors that are stopping it and help accelerate it. It'll do it by itself without help. But we need to move into it. Now is the time now of action. We've had a lot of thinking time, talking time, decision-making time. This whole environment green conversation has been going on since the 60s or whatever. But now it's time to put it into action. No one's saying we know the answers specifically, but you know how you can do a whole lot better. We all do. And just start doing that and feedback and talk to your neighbours and you'll kind of find yourself doing permaculture by accident without even anybody telling you what it is. It's that process.
Yeah.
And as you get into that process, you might find the books and networks and what have you, and the courses that exist, you know, interesting and useful.
And as you say, the way things are organised at the moment, almost anything we do is going to be an improvement.
Exactly, because we're doing, we signed the big global, hooray, climate change summit thing is signed, everybody comes home. What's the first thing the government do? They take, whatever it is, 11 billion, was it, off solar subsidies yesterday, and today they allow fracking in national parks. I mean...
Yeah, I gather that despite the fact that the people of Wales have said they're not going to be fracking here, the people in England have agreed that they can frack under the border. The rats.
Well, our MP voted for it. So,
did he? Well, I think personally addressing the people who are voting for it has got to be a good thing to be doing. I mean, the thing about the fracking is that it's so obvious that you're dealing with people who at least appear to be deliberately destroying the planet. That appears to be, you know, pretty undeniable, I would have thought.
And it's so short-termist at the best. I mean, it's not even likely that it'll make any money or produce any energy. But even if it did, it'll only last a few years, and then we'll have to go and build the wind farms that we should have built. Before.
Or indeed.
Everything else.
Yeah, or indeed access the other forms of energy that have for sure been available to our military for the last 40 or 50 years.
The biggest consumer of oil in the world is the US military. Because they know more about peak oil and they're more concerned about climate change than anybody.
Yeah.
Because the system that we have built, we could have done it in lots of different ways. There's other technologies you could have invested in, but we didn't invest in them. We invested in oil. And we've built the wrong infrastructure. And we can't carry on doing that. We've really got to stop doing it.
Well, I mean, in a way, the infrastructure itself is creaking horribly anyway.
But yeah, so the thought of to continue investing in things like fracking is doubly silly. You know, it's not a good, because it's got no future either, you know.
No, it'll just generate...
We all know that. I don't know, but... Anyway.
It's just going to generate... just going to generate a lot of money for a lot of people in the process, but that's really... In a sense, these bigger problems are only going to be addressed by starting with that first footstep and starting to change the little problems, isn't it? That's how the bigger picture will fix itself, if it's going to fix at all.
It's an emotional and intellectual journey before it begins to manifest itself outside of you. You know, you need to start thinking about this, what this means. Continually, 10% a year reduction, year on year, of carbon emissions. That is what is being asked of us. So the first 10%, not so hard. Second 10%, lower, more difficult. Third 10%, whoa. Starts getting really difficult then.
Yeah.
Because you can easily, you know, pick the low-hanging fruit first. And we do the easy stuff first.
But finding alternative ways of doing things on a much larger scale is what's actually got to happen. And I think that the changes that are required of us, as we said, nature is incredibly versatile, but if we don't choose to do them, they are going to be imposed upon us anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That is exactly right.
And in the meantime, taking a view which encourages resilience by bringing us back into community and by trying somehow to decompartmentalize economics, energy, food, and community. Those are the basic aims at this stage for us, yeah. Aren't they? Down here at the pixel level.
Yeah, to really understand how they each one relates and interrelates with each other. So that, yeah, the social economy, if you like, is the human power to turn the compost heaps and grow the food, distribute the food, and in that process, maintain community and, you know, human connection and all that sort of things on a very basic functional level.
And I think another...
And that'll do 90% of what the NHS does already, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually making people healthy and the interconnected, vibrant communities that are a little bit ill, really a bit of dandelion tea or whatever, and, you know.
That was another thing.
The bottle and a bit of love, and they'll be all right, you know. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're really sick, you need medicine, but if time it isn't. The problem with people's sickness, you know.
There was another thing that changed in Cuba, wasn't it, when they had their challenging period, was that people became a lot healthier.
Yeah, everybody lost, you know, 25 pounds in weight or something, and started cycling, and, yeah, go to bed earlier, because the lights went off.
Yeah, yeah.
They started having more sex, apparently.
And all of these things generally just improve the quality of life, and I find a kind of reduced stress, which is one of the other things we can do that's really helpful.
It's nice to be gently reminded of, you know, it's no cliche to say the best things or some of the best things in life are free, but because it's the human stuff. And actually, that's why I love about working in bits of, you know, a little bit of time I spent in Africa, but everything's been people-centric there. They're not too worried about things. They're really focused on people, which they're abundant in, and makes everything so much more fun and easy. And
that's how it was everywhere at one stage, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. That sort of social, openness and interaction, yeah.
Well, it's been...
What we will need going forward in our, whatever, bumpy times. But I think that, I'm beginning towards the end, we just have to summarise that.
Yeah.
To leave with a positive message is, you know, the change is always inevitable. It's always happening anyway. We're heading into some really big changes, but let's face it, we've known they've been coming. You can't really say nobody gave you a hint that it was coming. We need to get off oil really fast. If we don't, it'll be really, really bumpy and, you know, going over the precipice sort of stuff. And there will be some of that. But I think the major message is that this whole thing could be fun. But we need, you know, we can engage in it and learn and build a much more interesting, much more connected, much more localized world.
Mm. Yeah, I think
that's a permaculture message.
Yeah, I think that's a really sound message, and I really look forward to watching how your new housing co-op's going up there in Llanrhyadr. How is it at the Dragons Co-op?
Yeah, it's great. You're just kind of just I was at the Conscious Tribal Gathering doing my talk in July, August?
Yeah, July, so I think it was.
Right at the end, that's right, that was the day that I went to pick up the keys for the... So I did my talk about co-ops and then went off and picked up the keys for a new co-op, so...
Nice timing.
It feels right. It feels very, you know, trying to bring together lots of different strands, and yet again, it's still perhaps just another stepping stone to further ambitions too, but what we were saying before about trying to put some elements of infrastructure in place, little node points or whatever, where people can group together to start to have these kind of conversations a bit more, and that's what's fun with the new co-op is we've got a nice house, a little house, a little three-bedroom house to share, but we've got a shop and office space and a space to sort of sell community, you know, things produced by our community. And it's basically to come together and hang out. So, yeah.
And are you managing to cover the cost of the shop with the rent on the rooms that you've got?
We're paying no wages. We don't pay any wages. And the way that the shop works is, local craft artisans and artists put stuff in there. They rent a shelf for £5 a month. And we take 10% of what goes through the till. And the rest they get back. And that's the way it works. And so far, I think it's quite a lot of paperwork for the person who works out the payments. We're going to obviously put that onto a database at some point. So we don't pay any wages and the people in the shop, people use the shop, they're all makers and knitters and weavers and bits. And they're just sitting there making things, take a turn.
And it puts you effectively at the centre of a creative community, at a stroke.
Instantly, yeah. It is. It's really interesting. So it's already created its own, because by the fact that there's 34 different artists in there, and just them coming and going, creates a little internal economy of its own, you know. It's paying its way. It's not paying any wages, but all the artisans are getting, they're selling stuff, so.
And as you say, you've got the most important thing, which is a place where people can meet and discuss radical ideas like talking to each other.
Possibly sharing things.
Yeah.
On the very own notion that there won't be such a thing as enough. Yes.
Have you got any websites that you'd like people to know about?
Well, we've mentioned the co-op. That's dragonscooperative.org.uk. My permaculture teaching practice. I've got a website called permaculturedesigncourse.co.uk. Look at that. That you'll find about courses and stuff on there. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a real great pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to coming up and seeing you in the new year and having a browse in the shop.
Great. Excellent. And, we're kicking off. We're doing a permaculture course spread over 6 weekends, starting in the end of January. Sort of every other weekend, 6 weekends. So if anyone's interested, they can find out about that on the website.
Very good. Excellent stuff. I'll just post that. There we go. Post that one in there. permaculturedesigncourse.co.uk. Very good. I'll put the Dragons Cooperative one in there a bit later as well. But yeah, thank you very, very much for making the time to talk to us. And, I'll chat with you again, I'm sure.
Well, thanks again for having me. And, very happy Christmas and all of that to you.
Thank you very much, sir. And I'll speak with you again soon.
Cheers. Okay.
Cheers. Bye. Thanks, Steve. Thank you.